This week on Lunchbox Envy, Queen Elizabeth I had 2 pints of it for breakfast.
The Rarámuri people of Mexico use it to christen their babies.
And in the late Middle Ages, you could pay your taxes with it.
It's beer. Hello and welcome to Lunchbox Envy. I'm Jack and I'm here with my fellow QI elf, Manu. How's it going?
Good. How are you doing, Jack?
Fantastic.
We're also joined by food writer and chef Rosie. How are you doing, Rosie?
Hi, I'm so well.
Nice.
So should we crack open? What is beer? What is it?
A delicious elixir.
It's a fermented grain.
Yep.
Age old. We've been drinking it for, I think, about 13,000 years.
Wow, that is pretty old.
Is that older than wine?
Yes.
Wow.
I'm pretty sure we drank beer before we drank wine.
We were certainly cultivating cereals before we were cultivating grapes. So I think if you know, leave either of them to ferment and go off, occasionally they'll get alcoholic.
Mm-hmm. And actually, you always read in books. You always read in books.
Nice.
Yeah, I'm always reading in books.
I'm always reading in books that people would drink beer instead of water because it was safer.
Yeah.
Mm. And you'd get typhoid from the water, but you wouldn't from the beer and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a couple of caveats with that is I think you buy beer where you don't buy water. Mm-hmm. So you notice the beer and the gin coming up in records, whereas nobody's paying for water before Nestle came along.
I was
going to
say, they are definitely now.
It is still true in some cases. But also the other thing is the beer they were drinking is not what we think of as beer today.
Totally.
It was often a lot weaker and tastier and actually stodgier.
Mm.
So a lot of time it's known as liquid bread because it's made from the same ingredients. So imagine a flavoured porridge, and then you're much closer to what they were drinking thousands of years ago.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Ooh, flavoured porridge.
Love it.
Warm flavoured porridge. Yeah.
On a hot day.
No, I don't think so. Not for me.
Oh, it's funny you talk about the thickness of it, because there was a big debate about whether beer or bread came first. I don't know if you came across this yet. So in the 1950s, a professor called J.D. Sauer from the University of Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Interestingly, he's called J.D. Sauer.
Sour beer.
Yeah.
And J.D. Weatherspoons.
Ooh, yeah. It's a conspiracy. But he asked this question, which came first, beer or bread? Because the archaeological evidence is not conclusive, because a lot of the materials that you need to make both are really similar.
Yeah.
Some of the oldest surviving grains that we found are actually better suited for making beer than they are for bread.
Oh, interesting.
Mm-hmm. Which is really cool. And some people say that beer, the process of it would have actually been easier back in the day than making bread, because you don't need ovens. Don't need all of the baking bits and the receptacles. All you really need is the grain, because it contains a lot of the ingredients for natural fermentation anyway.
Mm.
And then there's also a method for making beer, which is just you start that fermentation off with human spit.
Oh, yeah, I read about this.
Yeah, it's super cool. So there's a drink in South America called chicha, which is made by chewing the flour at the start and then letting that all ferment. So they were like, it was actually a lot easier to make beer.
That's a good point.
But sensibly, people on the bread side were like, you cannot physically live off beer and protein alone. As much as we'd love to, it wouldn't be a very healthy population. And why would you do that when you had all of this available grain?
Yeah.
Choose the alcohol over bread. So... In the end, they met in the middle, and historians think that people first used grain to make a kind of gruel.
Yeah, I think back in the day, the lines were a bit more blurred. Mm-hmm. And you kind of have, sludgy beer or liquid bread.
Exactly.
And they were kind of the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
It would be helpful for me as someone who is, I would categorize myself as a basic bitch when it comes to beer. It would be helpful for me to know what are the differences. So if we could, let's talk about how to make it and also what are the different types.
Okay, so we're going to do a whistle stop tour, because like chocolate, there are 10 million steps.
So many.
Oh, God.
And
so
different.
Many.
Everyone has their own different technique.
It's bonkers. So we have 4 main ingredients, which are water. 90 to 95% of your beer is water.
Okay.
Then we have barley, or another kind of grain, like Jack mentioned. Then we have hops, which we'll talk about in a second. And then we have yeast, which is a fungus.
Oh, yes. I'm well acquainted.
Oh, God.
For cooking, to be clear.
Okay. No more questions. But yeah, hops are really cool. Hops are the flowers of the hop plant. Mm. Scientific name, Humulus lupulus, which I love.
Who sounds like a Harry Potter spell,
it
doesn't
does,
it?
It does, doesn't it? And they are cousins of the cannabis plant, which is why they smell like weed.
I was going to say they do smell a bit like weed, not that I know what it smells like. But
yes.
But yeah, hops, when you add them in the beer-making process, contributes to the bitterness and add specific aromas like citrus and banana. So that's where we get all of those amazing flavorings from. You can also only make beer with female hops because if you use male ones with seeds in them, the beer can taste a bit shit. So only lady hops in your beer.
Why am I not surprised?
And we have a really nice plate of dried hops that I brought today.
Mm, they smell fantastic.
They smell so good.
They smell like Hackney Wick.
Yeah, all of the hipsters.
Hopsters.
Oh, well done, Jack. Love it. Okay, so it starts with milling all your grain, so grinding it all up, and then mashing, which is adding loads of water, letting it steep, and then you boil the shit out of it, and you add the hops in that stage, and then you ferment it, so you add the yeasts, and that's where all of the amazing magical alcoholiness happens. The yeast start eating the sugars, pooping out alcohol. Great fun. One stage I didn't know about was pasteurizing, which happens with like big scale beer production. It's to stop any kind of nasty bacteria developing in the beer, so it has a really long shelf life. But Louis Pasteur, we think of milk fame pasteurization. Yeah, yeah. He's actually developing the process for beer.
Really?
I had no idea. So without beer, we might not have clean milk to drink with a crazy long
that
shelf life.
Very true.
Another thing to thank beer for.
Mm-hmm.
I think the main difference is between ale, which is warm fermented, and lagers, which are cold fermented. Yes. Am I right? Yeah, okay. Cold fermentation is about 10 degrees. The yeast all sinks to the bottom. It takes a lot longer.
Yeah.
And then the warm fermentation, the yeast all floats to the top and it takes much less time and it happens at about 18 degrees.
Mm-hmm. But also the carbonation is different.
Yes. Mm. Yeast, when it eats sugar, it converts it into alcohol, which is the bit that gets us drunk, and carbon dioxide, which is what makes the bubbles.
Ooh, fizzy.
Right.
And so if you have the yeast exposed to the sugars for less time, then there's less carbonation.
Sure.
Which is why ales are often not fizzy. Mm. But then also mass-produced lagers, they often add their own carbon dioxide in, just like a fizzy drink.
Ooh. Mm. I think one of my favourite things I have in my notes is lagers are bottoms and ales are tops. Which is a good way of remembering it.
And there's also, let's not forget, stout, which is a type of ale, but it has a much maltier flavour because it's uses extra malt, added malt in the brewing process.
And probably fewer hops.
And fewer hops, and
in somewhere in the process, I think it's just before you start boiling the shit out of it, one sprinkles the malt, which is the name for the roasted grain, sprinkles them lightly with water. And there's a specific word for this, which I slip into everyday conversation as much as I can. It's to sparge.
Ooh.
Just sparge.
To sparge.
Oh, to sparge.
To sparge.
So S-P-A-R-G-E.
How would you use that in a non-beer relative sentence?
Well, I can use it in a foodie context. Whenever you toast a pitta in the toaster.
Yes.
My dad used to sparge his pitta with a little bit of water, and that helps it to puff up and not dry out.
Wow. Interesting. So I like that. That's a good
my pittas.
Yeah.
On a hot day like today, I wouldn't mind a bit of a sparge sprinkle. Little light.
Careful what you wish for.
Okay.
Okay, let's crack into our first lunchbox, and that is mine. I have brought you guys today a real treat. It is 5,000-year-old beer.
Oh, God.
Not literally, but the recipe is from ancient Egypt.
Oh, nice.
Oh.
Where they used to drink a lot of beer. So let me pass them around.
Oh, it's lovely and cold.
Oh, yeah, it's a cold press.
Oh, God. It's really beautiful.
So I wonder if it'll make a nice noise.
It kind of looks like a pear juice that you might buy on the continent.
Yeah.
Oh, it does not smell like that, though.
To me, it smells like raw dough. Actually, hats off to you. Whatever you've made there is not bad.
The process was you toast bread and then you tear it into chunks and leave it in water with honey, sugar, yeast, and then you just leave it for 48 hours and then finally strain it. I don't know if it's food safe, but I think it's mildly alcoholic. It's basically liquid bread.
And why the straw?
So that's how the ancient Egyptians would have drunk it, because they weren't able to strain it in quite the same way. So in fact, they would actually drink it from the fermenting vessel. So while it was still fermenting.
Like, you know, those big party cocktail bucket things.
Yeah.
1,000 straws.
Yeah. The ancient Egyptians obviously didn't have plastic, so they would use reeds and hollow grasses as straws.
Right.
So should we go? Bottoms up?
No, it's not. It's okay. I just had a tiny sip.
It's one of those tastes where you're like, oh, kind of like a bad fart smell, where you're like, it's kind of intriguing.
That is close to beer.
Yeah.
I've definitely had some like dodgy lagers in backwater pubs that smell a bit like that.
The only thing that's kind of stopped me from believing that someone in Dalston made that is that it's cloudy. It looks like a fruit juice. If it was somehow clear, I probably would have paid £7.
Yeah,
I was going to say, probably pay more because of the cloudiness. That's when you know you've gone hipster and craft.
Yeah, true.
Yeah.
So apparently the Egyptians who built the pyramids were given 10 pints of beer a day.
Well, what?
Yeah.
It's thirsty work, man.
Well, it is. And like I said, it was quite nutritional. It was basically a gruel and it had a lot of vitamins and...
Mm-hmm. And I guess not as much alcohol as...
No, exactly. I think we can't be sure, but it was probably around 2% alcohol.
Oh, right.
So you'd be lightly sozzled after 10 pints, especially.
Yeah, but throughout the day.
Yeah,
well, exactly. Also you're sweating, you're climbing up a pyramid. Like.
Yeah. And there was an ancient Egyptian goddess called Hathor, who was the goddess of love, dance and beauty. So kind of similar to, I don't know, Venus or... Mm-hmm. But she was known as a lady of drunkenness. So they obviously like venerated the feeling of being drunk and thought it was quite holy. And to combine the two, it kind of makes sense.
Well, yeah. I like that it's a female god of drunkenness, because it's normally a Bacchus-esque person who's a bit naughty and it's always a bloke and they're, you know, essentially a lech. Whereas a nice Hathor giving it large for the girls, one of us.
It's really interesting because brewing beer has traditionally been women's work.
Absolutely.
Interesting.
Like all of the history of brewing, like it was all women doing this job, from Viking women to ancient Egyptian women. Like making the beer was part of your everyday kind of household routine and your household chores. So according to historian Lacan Brooks, a lot of unmarried women used to use brewing to support themselves if they didn't have husbands to do that. But then even married women would partner up with their husbands to help them run ale houses and brew beer. And then one of the reasons we kind of lost that association was because in the 1500s in Europe, during the height of Christian Reformation and all of this new religious zeal, the witch hunt started.
Them damn witch hunts.
Oh, yeah. And what's really interesting is that female brewers used to, apparently, wear kind of really pointy hats.
Oh, my God.
And carry their beer around in cauldrons. And often
sweep up all the hops.
And they'd have cats outside their breweries to keep the mice away from the grain. So there are some historians that think the kind of image we have of the stereotypical, like, witch outfit is from these female brewers. Yeah.
Well, witch's brew is a phrase, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. What's really cool, actually no, it's not cool, why am I saying that? It's really shit. So around this time, like, people were calling brewers witches because there's a lot of fear around women being able to support themselves. Also, like, brewing beer takes away from baby making time and baby raising time, and that's what women should be doing, obviously. So yeah, today brewing beer is still a super male dominated profession,
and it's, I would say, arguably a super male dominated product. Like,
yeah, oh my god,
so much advertising, so much of the packaging is built for men.
Yeah. Well, it's really interesting because we have this kind of long-standing image of monks brewing beer and making alcohol, but there's actually a smaller tradition of nuns brewing beer as well. So one of my favorite stories about women and beer
Women in beer, women in STEM and women in beer.
Not women in bikinis like swimming around a swimming pool of beer.
No, Jack. No, Jack. No. Stop it. Sister Doris Engelhardt, I really hope you're listening. She is the self-proclaimed last brewmeister nun living in Bavaria. She's in her 70s. Mm-hmm. She works at the Mahlersdorf Abbey Brewery. And she makes two beers, and you can only buy them from the nunnery. So her beer's called, Jack, help me.
Klosterbräu Mahlersdorf.
Thank you. She says she only brews beer that she would drink herself. She drinks about half a liter of beer a day. She's currently looking to retire and is looking for a replacement. So if anyone wants to take the mantle and be the brewmaster nun.
Do you have to be a nun?
I think you might have to be a nun. Oh, sorry, Jack.
That's okay.
But yeah, that's Sister Doris. Love it.
There's one bit of beer history that I really love, and it's linked to London, where we are now. The London beer flood of 1814.
Oh, yeah. I know about this. Yeah.
So it was in Tottenham Court Road. There's a theatre called the Dominion Theatre there now. And on that site, before the 1920s, was a brewery called Moe & Company. Moe & Co. So they had these enormous vats of beer, which hold thousands of litres, as we do today. But these were made of wood and fastened by rings of iron. You picture like an old-fashioned barrel. Mm. And then just out of nowhere one day in October, one of them split. And then the resulting wave tipped over like a domino effect many of the other vats in this brewery. And about 2.5 million pints of mostly London porter, actually. So picture, you know, like a very dark beer. A tidal wave flooded through the streets, demolished buildings. And unfortunately, it did kill 8 people, 5 of whom, in a tragicomic way, were actually at a funeral. I don't know if that's funny or not. But yeah, it must have been quite the sight.
Yeah. And sticky.
Someone must have drank it.
I think so. I think people were, because it was quite a poor area of London, they were sort of overwhelmed at the amount of free beer they could have.
Free beer from what? Like the puddles? Like,
It's time for our second lunchbox. And today that's yours, Manu. What have you brought?
Okay, well, we've got some ordinary cans of beer in our lunchboxes.
Oh, so we do.
I want you guys to pour yourself a beer.
Absolutely, with pleasure. It's a good noise. So I'm going to start with my glass tilted to about 45 degrees. And then I guess I'm going to pour. I've just done by instinct, really. I guess the idea of the tilt is to decrease the amount of head so that you get as much beer in the glass as possible. And no annoying bubbles. Look at that.
Jack, I'm going to copy you and just do it exactly the same way.
Ooh, it's a bit okay, paler, very isn't it? Nice.
That's because she's a food stylist, ladies and gents.
Yeah. Well done.
So, Manny, what are you going to explain that we've been doing it wrong?
Oh, Jack, you are so, so ill informed.
Oh, no.
This is how the beer nerds say you should pour a beer. So, I'm going to open mine.
Okay, so looking promising, you're starting the same way.
Same angle.
But as I'm pouring, I'm going to fix the tilt and I'm on a lot more height.
Oh, wow.
I know. And I'm really trying to go for those bubbles.
Aggressive.
Wow. Do you want some beer with your head?
Oh, it's a thing of beauty. So there is so much head on that bit.
Yeah, I would say that was badly poured. Can you justify it?
Well, so when I lived in the Netherlands, the first time I was poured a beer, I took it back and I was like, excuse me, sir, this is head. There is no beer, re-pour it. And he looked at me and he was like, oh, stupid English person. No. This is how we're supposed to drink beer. And they were right. So,
Whoa. Surely this is subjective.
The biggest reason you should pour your beer with more head is because when you do that tilting and slow pour, you're not activating the CO2. Like, all of those bubbles are staying in the beer. So I have a rolled up tissue. I'm going to put it in your beer, Jack.
Is it clean?
You ready? Yes, it is clean. Good. Okay.
So it's foamed up an awful lot.
Look, and the head's come back.
And the head's appeared.
So.
Oh, wow.
Imagine this is happening in your stomach. If you pour your beer the way you poured it with no head, as soon as you eat something, all of that CO2 is going to go mad and it's going to fizz up in your stomach.
And it makes me gassy.
Exactly. That's why you feel so bloated. Whereas if you get the head first in the pour, it's not going crazy on your stomach and it doesn't make you feel this shit.
There you go.
I know.
So technically, it is actually meaning you can drink more beer because you have more space in your tummy because you're not bloated by the CO2.
Another really good thing about having more head on your beer is it kind of creates a thicker layer which should prevent oxidization, which can ruin the flavor of your beer. And the head traps aromas in a really nice way. So it actually like intensifies your kind of flavor experience of the beer, which is just, I think it's super cool.
So who spread this misinformation that your head shouldn't be, you know, as thick as what you just poured?
Well, I think it's about stinginess, because if you go to a British pub and they'll serve you, what, a third head and the rest beer, by the time those bubbles have disappeared, your pint glass isn't full. It's only two-thirds full. So people will complain. And by rights, you can go and say, no, I want that topped up. And they'll
I've paid for beer, not head.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. But presumably did you say the Netherlands? They're much less bothered about bang for buck and they want it to taste a bit better. This is just cultural.
Yeah, it's definitely cultural.
Do you know we actually use this trick in food styling a little bit?
No way. Really?
So quite often when you're doing photography stills and there are, you might have put a couple of beers on the set. Obviously, by the time you've got beer in glasses, food on the table, the angles are all good. A lot of the time, the beer can just settle.
Yeah.
So I typically use just a bamboo chopstick.
All right.
And for some reason, bamboo seems to react with the beer. Mm. But it also must be because I'm pouring it terribly, to be clear. Now I know. So I can quickly stick my chopstick in. The nice fizz comes back up to the top, gets a little bit of a head, photographer takes a picture, beer looks perfect.
Nice.
And that is a classic. And the other thing we'd use as well, because after a few goes, that doesn't work because obviously the gas has done its work. Yeah. The other thing people will do is put a little bit of sugar in it to make it fizz.
It's all about the nucleation sites, isn't it? So anything that's kind of rough texture, the CO2 can like almost sort of catch hold of it and then make a bubble.
Which is why when you see glasses with loads of bubbles on the edge, you know they're really dirty.
Well, at least they've got little tiny bits of dust in. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or they've been scratched. That's actually why champagne in the glass has bubbles, because there's lots of tiny imperfections in the glass that cause the bubbles to froth up. And in fact, at the bottom of many pint glasses, you have a sort of laser etching, which creates those nucleation sites and makes it all kind of constantly bubble from the bottom, which these glasses actually have.
Right.
And you'll notice it on pint glasses.
So that you get a constant pretty stream.
Yeah, so that it kind of looks
a
bit prettier. Yeah, exactly.
Nice.
Not
clever.
So flat. Interestingly, a lot of the pint glasses, the actual line which says this is a pint is not at the top. It's a bit further down.
Yeah.
So a lot of the time when you ask for that extra little top up, it's slightly more than a pint. Yeah.
But yeah, it got me thinking about how we drink beer and pour beer in different countries. One of my favourite things is in Qingdao in East China. It's a city. They drink beer out of a bag.
With a straw.
It's more to do with transportation. So they're really famous for their draft beer. But instead of pouring it straight into the glass, what they'll do is they'll pour it into like branded plastic bags, which they kind of can take around with them, and they can like serve it to people.
Over your shoulder.
Yeah, no, legit. It's really cute. And then they have a hole in it, which you can like pour into the pint glass.
How do they keep it cold?
Wait, a hole? Where's the hole?
It's in the middle of the bag. It's mad.
How does it not come out?
I think they might cut it when they're pouring it. So you have the bag, and then when you're ready to pour, you're like... So people are just walking around with like bags of beer.
Qingdao is one of the biggest breweries, because there used to be a German port there.
Oh.
And that's why they've got one of the biggest beers in China.
Oh, wow.
Not the biggest. Do you know the best-selling beer in the world?
Mm-hmm.
We'll see if you can guess.
Guinness.
Budweiser.
Nope, neither of those. It's Snow Beer.
What's Snow Beer?
Well, exactly. It's the most popular beer in China.
Right.
And given that its population is enormous, it's actually the best-selling beer in the world.
Oh, that's crazy.
I know. I've never had any. I've never even seen it in the shops.
No. Oh, I want to try it now.
Yeah, I know. Me too.
So whilst we're talking about countries that love beer, Belgium, famous for their beer.
Oh, yeah.
I am never that interested in plumbing, but this has caught my eye. They have an underground beer pipeline.
What?
It's so cool. So
wait, can I tap that? Sorry.
What?
I mean, like, can I divert some of it to my house and make a tap? I didn't mean it in that
I have way. Been to Bruges and I didn't know about this.
Dirty well, nice. Because it's hidden underground.
Right.
So basically, in 2016, a beer company called De Havemann Brewery, their factory was in one place, but their bottling plant was in another place, 3 kilometres away. And they were having such issues transporting it through this tiny historic city. Mm. And they were messing up all of the roads and like creating traffic and loads of noise. So their solution was to build an underground pipeline that was like 3.2 kilometers long, carrying roughly 4,000 liters of beer an hour.
Wow.
Under the city. And it was part funded through crowdfunding, where locals could buy shares or like lifetime beer rewards.
Genius.
I know. So clever.
That is clever.
So I'm just picturing it. It's like a tube of beer flowing one way. Would that be like next to the sewers flowing piss the other way?
Oh, I hope not.
And then they sell it as Foster's at the other end.
Oh.
Let's open our final lunchbox. And today, that is Rosie. What have you brought, Rosie?
I've brought something to soak it all up.
Oh,
after all those beers we've been drinking and not drinking, if you're me. I have brought Welsh Rabbit with me today.
Oh, lovely.
Nice.
Do you know what Welsh Rabbit is?
I feel like I should because my boyfriend is half Welsh, but I don't.
Okay.
I mean, the simpleton's answer is it's cheese on toast. I think it's made slightly differently. I think you melt the cheese in a pan so it's much more liquid and then you spread it over toast, basically. Mm. Maybe even grill it.
Yeah, I mean, you're not far off. So Welsh Rabbit is essentially cheese on toast, but what you do is you make a kind of a pseudo cheese sauce.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And some recipes use milk, but most recipes use beer.
Ooh.
In this case, stout.
Nice.
But you can use ale or you can even just use beer. This cheese sauce then goes on the toast and it gets grilled and it becomes kind of like bubbly, rich, but also quite yeasty, sour flavor.
It's and liquid bread on bread.
It's kind of liquid bread. Yeah, it's double carb.
Wow.
And it's also very, very good with Worcester sauce, which you can see on top.
I was going to say, I can smell.
I'm sure you can smell it.
Worcestershire's not far from Wales.
It's not that far, no. So Welsh Rabbit basically first appeared in the early 18th century, but actually it wasn't called rabbit, it was called Welsh Rabbit.
Okay.
And they think that was because Welsh people were really poor. There was, you know, a lot of like discrimination against the Welsh, and they couldn't afford even the cheapest of meats, rabbit. So this cheese on toast was their equivalent.
Okay.
Oh. Can't really work out why it started being called rabbit instead of rabbit. You should actually say rabbit.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Wasn't it the sort of posh English people by saying, oh, Welsh rabbit?
That does sound a bit like us, to be fair. There are actually English and Scottish rabbits as well.
No way.
But they aren't as popular.
I didn't know about
For very good reason, really. English rabbit particularly sounds horrendous. A slice of toast, which you throw a glass of red wine on, then you put cheese on and then you grill it.
Wow.
What? Why?
I don't know why. Add up. And then Scottish rabbit is a slice of toast, and then you just grill the cheese by itself. How you go about grilling a slice of cheese and like and getting it onto the toast, like just a bit faffy, basically. Yeah.
And then Italian Welsh rabbit is pizza.
Well, yes. Listen, Welsh rabbit is actually really popular worldwide. Mm-hmm. In the States, they love it.
Ooh. I mean, well, it's pretty American looking, to be fair.
It's like an open grilled cheese, right?
Yeah, it's a very dinery thing. But the funny thing is that I think in the UK for a long time, it is actually served as like a pudding.
Oh, really?
And actually in St John, the very famous British restaurant here in London, you can get Welsh rabbit as a pudding.
Wow.
That is like a pudding is a particularly
like
a
cheese course, I suppose, right?
Yeah. Should we have a bit?
Oh, I'd love to, cheese. Yeah. You got that perfect, you know, when cheese melts and then re-solidifies and it makes like little grilled sort of nuggets.
Oh, it smells so good.
Mm.
Oh, yeah. That goes down a treat.
The recipe for Welsh rabbit, it varies, but I've actually used food writer Felicity Cloak's recipe today. She used to write a column for The Guardian called The Perfect.
Mm.
And it's a brilliant column.
I love it, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And she would do a lot of research into one particular dish, summarise lots of different thoughts and recipes on it, and come up with the sort of perfect version of it.
Mm.
And it's 1 teaspoon of mustard powder, 3 tablespoons of stout. I use Guinness because I've always got it in my house. butter, Worcestershire sauce. Technically, we should be using probably like Lancashire cheese or a Welsh cheese, but I couldn't find those, so I just use cheddar. And so what you do is you make a very thin roux, add the butter and the stout, then you melt the cheese into that with the Worcestershire sauce, then you bind it with the egg yolks and you spread that on your toasted bread. So it's a bit more involved than a normal grilled cheese, but it's actually really quite delicious.
It's worth it, man.
I always felt sorry for Felicity Cloak's family because she would say, like, all week I've been cooking spaghetti alla vongole, or, you know, Welsh rarebit. And she'd presumably just serve up dinner and was like, oh, yeah, another Welsh rarebit for you to try. In fact, what is it like for Tom when you're your partner, when you're cooking recipes all day?
I think it's usually quite great, really. Like, usually he's thrilled with whatever I've made him. There are, like, obviously times when it's like 8:30 a.m. and I'm like, Tom, there's a chicken Kiev here, like, do you want a chicken Kiev? I need to get rid of it, like, kind of thing. And he'll be like, oh, okay. And I get more sick of my own food than he does. Like, I don't want to eat my food sometimes after I've been on a big testing or big writing spree. It's just get me a McDonald's. Just anything else. Well, anyway, so other versions of Welsh rarebit do include flour, and other versions also do include milk instead of beer. Okay. But I couldn't really find a good reason why beer was being used, other than it was just widely available, cheap. And I think beer and cheese are great together.
Mm-hmm. A fantastic combo.
And it's like that yeasty, sour maltiness in that sauce that really adds something. Whereas if it was made with milk, it would just taste creamy, wouldn't it? It wouldn't be the same thing.
Agreed.
The one thing that does make beer in this cheese sauce a little bit trickier to work with, I would say, maybe than milk, is that because beer has less fat, no fat molecules or virtually none, as opposed to milk having loads, there isn't much for the fat and the cheese to stick to emulsify with. So it can look a bit grainy and split sometimes when you're making it, but that is just the name of the game. And in the States, there are a couple of versions. Blushing Bunny has tomato soup added in.
Oh,
wow.
They love this whole rabbit theme.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Buck Rarebit is topped with a whole fried egg.
Oh, that like sounds croque madame. So good.
Yeah. So, beer and cheese, as we said, a great pairing.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, both fermented.
Both fermented. Mm-hmm. Both very delicious. Both great.
Ancient, probably.
For before and after a hangover. During the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
There is actually a beer cheese dip in the States called literally called beer cheese.
Wow.
Unfortunately, they didn't come up with a cooler name. And it's from Kentucky, and it's made with sharp cheddar, beer, cayenne, garlic, mustard, horseradish. So it's a bit spicy.
Wow,
actually sounds so good. Yeah, I'm really into it.
Send us some.
And in Winchester, Kentucky, they host a beer cheese festival every year.
Whoa.
You go to this festival, you eat your beer cheese, you drink local craft beers and artisanal cheese and have a jolly nice time. Sounds like the hipster's dream.
Yeah.
I did go to a beer and cheese tasting once.
Did you?
Really?
Mm-hmm. Was it great?
You know what? There's just so much volume.
Yes.
They obviously were not pouring their beer properly.
Oh, no.
They're left like waddled out of there.
So I wanted to talk a bit about beer and cooking generally because actually it isn't as prolific as wine.
Mm.
It's not something we cook with as much.
Mm.
And I think the primary reason for that is that while wine has higher acidity than beer, beer has actually, by nature, much more bitterness.
Mm. Mm. Yeah.
So when you cook with it, it can be quite hard to balance out.
Mm.
It doesn't work as well, isn't as malleable as wine is with other flavors. And wine reduces to sweetness, whereas beer doesn't do that so much. Wine has more sugar in it. But there are three areas you will find beer in cookery.
Mm-hmm.
Hit me.
Well, do you think you know what they are?
Jelly.
Pie. Pie. In a stew.
No, marinating.
Marinating?
Damn you.
Sorry, Manny.
You were close to stew.
Stewing.
Perfect.
Thank you.
Stewing, marinating.
Okay, and there's one more.
The last one, which you will probably rarely, if ever, see wine, is actually leavening.
Oh.
So, oh. Beer and bread.
Because it's got the yeast.
My pizza dough.
Yeah, your pizza dough.
Yeah. Course. I made pizza dough the other day with beer for the pizza episode. Okay, so for slow cooks, beer braises, that's mm-hmm. We're all very comfortable with that. We know that beer does nice things to meat. Mm-hmm. More typically ales rather than your lagers, because they are a little bit sweeter, less carbonated.
Yeah.
And there is a Belgian dish called carbonade flamande, which is basically a beef and beer stew.
Sure. Mm.
And it's notable because it forms part of the Belgian tradition of cuisine à la bière, which is basically cookery with beer. And this was popularized in the 50s by the famous Belgian chef Raoul Mollichem.
Oh.
Thank you. If my Flemish isn't good, don't tell me. And basically, it's the practice of incorporating and pairing beer at every moment in a meal.
Okay.
So in these instances, beer does not just get relegated to meat and, you know, the normal sort of places. It's in salads, it's in sauces, it's in puddings as well.
Wow.
Nigella Lawson has a very famous Guinness cake.
Mm-hmm. Guinness cake is a great cake. It's just delicious. They're but really Guinness and cake, 10 mm-hmm. out of 10. Yeah.
Oh, so good.
Did you know in the 50s you used to be able to get a warm Guinness?
No.
Really?
They called it hot porter. So the British pub, they had a little feature on the typical 1950s English pub. Mm. And then they show footage of a man with a pint of dark beer. Mm-hmm. And then he takes a hot poker from the fire and just sticks it straight in his glass. Oh. And you see it all like bubbling up.
No way.
After like a minute, he takes it out and it's just like a hot steaming pint of beer.
That's crazy.
How far we've come.
Wow. How far we've come.
I wouldn't put it past some hipsters.
I know people who drink room temp like lager and they're like, no, it's way better this way.
You do get more taste.
No, but the joy is
this is practically room temp now.
Okay, first. But I think the joy is like the cold crispness.
Do you guys like beer cocktails?
Is this like beyond a shandy?
Well, a shandy is definitely one of those things. Yeah, yeah. Actually, when I just was on holiday in Sicily, my husband got they called it a birra sporca.
Ah.
And it was basically a scoop of lemon granita, which is granita's like shaved ice. Mm. And then a beer poured over it.
Oh,
wow. That's a shandy I can get behind. I'll tell you that.
Really good.
It's actually not my favorite beer cocktail. Okay. My favorite beer cocktail is a michelada, which is from Mexico.
Oh, what is?
I love these.
Oh my God, Manu. They are quite Marmite-y, I would actually say. In more ways than one. Taste a bit Marmite-y.
As in love them or hate them.
Yeah, some people... Basically, the beer is seasoned with kind of like a soy sauce mix.
Mm-hmm.
Loads of tahini, which is like a chili lime seasoning.
Yeah.
Lime juice. In some cases, you can have it with tomato juice as well. That's a type of michelada. But I like a classic one, which is literally just like heavily seasoned beer.
Mm-hmm.
It's so refreshing. It's somehow more refreshing than a normal beer because it's so salty. It kind of hydrates you better.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a little bit spicy. And oh my God, I tell you right now, if I wasn't pregnant, I'd be absolutely sending the micheladas home.
Wow.
There's another one I tried last summer, which I saw online. It's called a spaghetti, as in like basically like spaghetti.
Somebody touch my spaghetti.
Somebody touch my spaghetti. And it's essentially...
Okay, that's lost on Manny.
I'm just happy to be...
So you drink, you know, the first maybe like two thumbs of beer out of your bottle. And then you top it up with just about to be frozen Aperol.
Oh.
And then so it's cold as hell Aperol in your already quite cold beer. And it basically is like a sort of beer spritz.
Wow.
It's really good.
That sounds banging.
Mm.
See, again, with the cold beers, I just don't think you get...
Oh.
You're just looking for refreshment and drunkenness rather than taste.
You are wrong. I am so sorry.
Those are legitimate things to go for.
But I'm not drinking beer to like taste the 1,000 years of hops in it. I'm drinking beer to feel refreshed.
Yeah, of course.
And that needs to be cold.
Oh, I think we should wrap up because I'm feeling a bit gambrinous. I don't know about you guys.
Oh, wait.
What Say again.
Gambrinous. It means full of beer.
Oh, that's a useful one.
You can follow our socials for foodie facts and podcast updates. We are on X, Facebook, Instagram and TikTok at Lunchbox Envy Pod.
You can also get in touch and send us your facts, recipes and questions by emailing us lunchbox@qi.com.
So, just to wrap up, has anyone got any parting favourite beers that they want to shout out?
Can I shout anything by Beak? It's a brewery in Lewes near Brighton and their stuff is bonkers tasty. Beak. Mm-hmm. Oh, Beak. B-E-A-K.
My favourite brewery, I think, is Magic Rock up in Huddersfield. They do some really smart, they're kind of beer nerds about it, but like they've got cool looking cans as well.
Nice.
I'm a big Italian beers girl. Yeah. And to be honest, my favourite beer is Ichnusa, which is Sardinian.
Yes.
And it's very iconic branding and very delicious. The best one is the non-filtrata.
Mm. Interesting. Oh. Cool. All right. We'll leave you with this Czech proverb. A fine beer may be judged with only one sip, but it's better to be thoroughly sure. We'll see you next week. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
Lunchbox Envy was hosted by Manu Henriot, Rosie McKean, and me, Jack Chambers. It was mixed by Li Ying Lee and produced by Alex Bell. This has been a quite interesting podcast.